In New York City, 72 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today the show features the role of historical consciousness and global student movements. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Freedom Sounds by The Scatterlights. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for supporting Africa Now and WPFW during our recent Spring Pledge Drive. Your support enables us to continue to cover and connect the issues facing the African world and the rest of the globe. June 16 is the Day of the African Child, or Soweto Day. The day is set aside to commemorate the youth who rose up against apartheid South Africa on June 16, 1976 in Soweto, South Africa. As such, and also highlighting the current student movements, particularly those in solidarity with Palestine, the discussion contextualizes student movements historically and globally. The conversation with Mukasa Dada and Obi Aguna Jr. focuses on the ongoing fight for Black liberation and the need for solidarity across different oppressed groups. The development and maintenance of historical consciousness alongside organizing efforts that challenge imperialism, neocolonialism, and police brutality through direct action and community engagement are presented in the discussion to accurately understand the potentialities of the moment. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Mukasa Dada and Obi Egbuna Jr.
Flow, there's nothing but give facelifts, make the space shift. I'm the same on the top as on the bottom. It's like making the A flip. I got dudes on corners who make A flips. One shot, have a dude making A flips into a handstand. Playing with the bandstand, began with the tan van. The fans are grand slams. Barry Bonds style, night in it. I'm in the zone, home run. Watching the highlights when I'm getting home. Like, yeah, that's me. High the bass beat, walking with that.
I want to take the time to thank two important thinkers, organizers, political, social, cultural theorists to join us today, Brother Mukasa and Brother Obi Egbuna Jr., to really have a conversation about this current particular moment in the context of youth and student movements that are happening not only here in the United States, but also globally. And what I wanted to do today is to really do three things. The first thing is kind of get into a genealogy, moving from obviously Brother Mukasa, the deep impact, and specifically, you know, throughout, you know, the 60s, and then moving into the 90s, Brother Obi. And of course, the idea is to have a cross conversation here. But, you know, to develop a historical consciousness, there's three things that I think that provides a important platform for those who are engaged in this program and those who are engaging on the ground work. Again, whether here in the United States or globally, what does this moment mean? Because we obviously want to look at this historical context, but also we want to look at some lessons. And then the third thing we want to talk about, why is it important to have an internationalist perspective linking the things that are happening on campuses and the target or the primary target and linking it to, you know, the violent repression that is happening in the longer genealogy of student movements here in the United States and again abroad, linking that to obviously the global condition. So as we begin, you know, those three things, what does this moment mean? What are some lessons? And why is it important to have, you know, this internationalist perspective linking and finding continuities in this moment? So Brother Mukasa, what does this moment mean in the context from the perspective of someone who was on the ground, who was very, very involved in shaping and also organizing? And then, of course, we'll move to Brother Obi, and you can respond, you know, with comments to each other as well. So Brother Mukasa, what does this moment mean? How are we supposed to understand this moment in the historical genealogy of student movements?
Well, it's just an expression that our people are still oppressed, still in slavery, and that the people are frustrated and the people are trying to figure out how and where do we go from here. And that in my early days, we had to go in the back doors and sharecrop and face all the injustice that are dehumanizing a people. And that the people at one point, well, if you go back to Garvey days, you know, Marcus Garvey organized world movement. And then you had great men like Paul Robeson and other voices that have spoke out here. But then when you, in my day, this people started sitting in saying they refused to go in the back doors and say yes, sir, and rebel against those kinds of things. And from that, movements were born, organizations were born, and we found ourselves confrontational with the oppressor. And that, so therefore I joined, helped put together a group called SENCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And that, we went to just tell our people to unite. And when we walked and marched and spoke out against this oppression, we faced guns, we faced bombs, we faced jail and all other kinds of things that say to us that we were under a colonialism or under segregation or under racism, and that we were not to be equal to nobody else in the world. So when we started fighting, it just led us to build organizations and create leaders that came out of that movement, from Malcolm to Martin and many others. And that, so I just found myself in the middle of a big fire, a movement fire. And today we're still in that movement fire. So I'm definitely a soldier, but I became a soldier by just going out with so many others that pushed me and other people to the front to fight. And there are so many, even the people on the back line were great soldiers also. And many of them fought, jailed, shot, died, and never left their names. But so many heroes have struggled for our liberation and made the changes that we have today and continue to fight for those changes. And that's where I start there.
No, thank you, Brother Obi. You know, Brother Mikasa is talking about this structural white supremacy that is rooted in imperial and colonial logic, right? So, you know, as someone who was very, very integral and very, very involved with collectives of folk and establishing organizations, but also being trained by a lot of folk who were in the continuity of the movements that Brother Mikasa is talking about, how do we understand this moment and what does this moment mean? And as we're moving into what we would call, obviously, the 90s or the late 80s going into the 90s.
Well, I'm privileged to say that Brother Mikasa was one of the people who trained me. Our point of entry, it comes down to capacity and demographic. As he so brilliantly articulated, the role of students and youth, it's a constant, especially for us culturally. Whether you want to use the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as your backdrop or the Southern Negro Youth Congress in the 1930s as your backdrop, whether you want to use South African Student Organization where Steve Biko gets his start, the General Union of Palestinian Students where Yasser Arafat gets his start, the University Federation of Students in Havana where Comandante Fidel Castro gets his start, It's a consistent thing throughout history, especially for us as Africans culturally. For us, it begins in 1989, where we found ourselves fighting the National Guard in 1989 in Virginia Beach. And then the following year, in 1990, we organized a boycott of Virginia Beach. Think about boycotting a HBCU tradition of that magnitude. But the fascism and repression drove us to do that. Of course, we're always guided by things that are going on at that particular juncture. So this is going on around the time that Mandela, simultaneous with the release of Nelson Mandela, simultaneous with the independence of Namibia, who gained their independence in 1990, which many people have a tendency to overshadow. And of course, we're called Generation X because our generation is recredited with considering Malcolm X the symbol of our resistance in the 90s. Heavy blending of nationalist sentiment, Pan-Africanist sentiment. So you had that going on. Then by 1992, we shut down the country for what is called the Rodney King Uprising. Oh, and in 1991, you have the independence of Eritrea. So we're inspired by that. And then in the 1990s, you begin to see African youth on the continent fighting against military neocolonialism. So you see Babangida and Abacha in Nigeria shown the door. You see Traore in Mali, who the CIA used to overthrow Modibo Keita, shown the door. You see more resistance to UNITA and RENAMO, the CIA installations in Southern Africa. This is all being spearheaded by young people. And then, of course, the way we rebelled dealing with the Rodney King question, it reminded people of the 289 city rebellion that took place between 1965 and 1968. And then by 1995, you have a million man march. So you have this constant where national marches are organized to put the lid on our resistance, the same way that the March on Washington in 1963 was organized to put a lid on our resistance. And the same way that the suffrage parade in 1913 attempted to curtail the efforts of the National Association of Colored Women. So African resistance in its most organic sense, you see women at the forefront of the effort. You see churches at the forefront of the effort, and you see students and youth. So we just played our role, but those were the things that were influenced us. And then in 1991, we had a all-African student youth conference. And Mukasa stands up in the middle of the floor because it's Easter weekend, and he's reminding us that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is founded Easter weekend at Shaw University in 1960, and there was no way we could leave that conference without an organization. And out of that, you had the Pan-African Student Youth Movement. And in the same way that you had the sit-ins happening, for us, it was administration building takeovers. Starting with the University of Maryland, Baltimore County in 1988. UDC had one, my alma mater, Howard had one, numerous ones all over the country. So the need to have a permanent organizational structure, permanent organizational formation, this was, we adhere to the wisdom of those who were experienced and were willing to train us and take us through the process.
So Brother Mukasa, you know, Obi opened, you know, the doorway to us really understanding, you know, the importance of developing an ideological development that is rooted in internationalism. He mentioned, you know, briefly as you being one of his particular trainers and mentors. From the perspective, on the ground perspective, as you are training, as you are actually understanding the anti-colonialist movements that are happening, because again, you know, Obi's inheriting, you know, this genealogy that is being passed down, right? I think it's important to talk about that. What is some of the lessons, or how important was it as youth and young folks that you were involved with, helping start organizations, your travels to the continent of Africa as well, being able to understand the connections of the colonial situation in other countries and the colonial situation here in the United States?
Well, Malcolm X explained that. He said, if you don't understand what's going on in the Congo or what's going on in Zimbabwe or what's going on in Egypt or what's going on in Palestine and other places around the world, then you can't understand what's going on in Alabama, what's going on in Mississippi. And otherwise, you got to look at the big picture. And when we began to look at our picture, we were able to see that the black people, African people, were struggling in Ghana, in the Congo, where Lumumba, Patrice Lumumba, was the prime minister. And the white people in the Congo had killed, colonialists has killed over 60 million Africans, cut their ears off, cut their feet off, cut their hands off because they didn't work hard enough. And we could link that up with the fact that we went in the outfields in Alabama, picking cotton and being lynched and castrated and murdered and working for nothing. And then, so it became very clear that our struggle, wherever we are, was linked up with all the struggles in the world. And we began to just see them a little more. And now we got information centers, and we can see much more than what we just hear about or talk about. We see the United States slaughtering the people in Palestine. And it's very clear that Joe Biden is top gun in Palestine. Joe Biden is top gun, and Democrats and all of them saying is top gun in the Congo, top guns in killing people all over the world, passing nuclear bombs, spending billions on bombs and around the world, and won't spend a nickel or dime on a hungry person under a bridge. And they still building slave ships, jails and prisons are nothing but slave ships. And they got these military bases all over the world. And that, so we still find ourselves in slavery. And that, when we just open up, we began to see a bigger picture. And that one thing we worked out there in them cotton fields and worked in these different places and made basically nothing. But it become very clear that land is the basis of us being liberated. And now we debate what land are we fighting for? And it's very clear that our land is Africa. And in order for us to be liberated and free, we got to stop all of our natural resources that's coming out of the ground, going to Europe and other places in the world, and leaving us with nothing on our land. They steal peanuts, they steal mangoes. They got our people in the Congo out there picking diamonds and gold and coltan and cobalt, just like your grandmama, and just like pick cotton. And that's, so it is no different. This is one world system that's raping and robbing the world. They got one world army. I know we faced a little shab in Alabama and Mississippi, but now we can see there's one world army that's controlled by, they're led by the United States, the UA, or however, European armies. NATO is being controlled by the United States. They use all these armies to commit crimes on the people of color and rape the land of the people. So all our little local struggles have to come together and build all our movements, all our little gang members have to come together and build an army and have an ideological base that we have to give to the different little brothers and sisters and our people that say that we come together and now we use our youth to fight for us. Because if you fight one European nation, you got to fight them all. When we fought in Angola, we were fighting the whole of NATO and the United States. We fought in South Africa, we were fighting the United States and the whole of NATO. Whenever we fight anywhere in the world against these European colonialists that come to steal your land and murder your people, jail your people, and all the crimes they commit, you're fighting against all of them together. They put their armies together and fight. Now it's time for us to put our ideological forces together, put our children, our people together, our organization together, and our armies, best we have, put them together, and then we can face the imperialist armies. And that when we talk about coming together, Marcus Garvey and Du Bois and many other leaders like Nkrumah and Lumumba and Sekou Toure and Amakaka Bra, they call it Pan-Africanism. That means all of us work together for the unity that we talk about. And we could name 1,000 different little purifiers that we are fighting in everywhere, because every acre of land that we live on in the world, we oppress, and every acre land wherever we are oppressed, there are some forms of fighting, rebellion, and saying no to these people. In some places, we're able to say it stronger than we are in other places, but we're still saying it and doing the best. And I think now we're talking about how do we put these forces together and let all of us see that we're fighting one struggle for our liberation, and we're fighting against one world enemy. And Joe Biden is top gun.
And I'm also, and what is important in the context, because I also hear the importance of utilizing these platforms. So these encampments that are happening on college campuses, again, in a global context, Can these be platforms? Can these be spaces where there can be a proliferation of putting these ideological forces that also leads to a particular objective, which is obviously removing the colonial structures that are still repressing, you know, peoples in Haiti and peoples, you know, in Cuba, all that. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, it always has been and it always will be. Through this process, we've been working with young people on three campuses in particular. Brown, Ethan, a young brother named Ethan Levine, Cornell, a brother named Mamoudou Tsao, and at the University of Maryland, Adam Ganou. Adam Ganou is the president of the Palestinian Student Association and Muslim Student Association there. The challenge is, well, I think it's great because one of the most beautiful characteristics of history itself is the challenges that it imposes. And a lot of times when we talk about the great iconic figures that have profound influence on us, we give their analysis, we quote, we talk about their ideological impact, but we don't talk about the labor. So if for people, as Malcolm X's 99th birthday is coming up, we must remind people that he was the first one to work with the Palestinians in our community. You can find the pictures of him with Ahmed Shoukry, the first chairman of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And then when you know that in Libya in 1990, in the fall, you had the worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front. And the objective of that was to show that Zionism was a direct enemy of African people. So right now, we want to compliment, we want to, because there's a difference between sympathy, solidarity, and camaraderie. And what you see just by circumstance is taking on the character of sympathy. For Africans, we can't say we're in solidarity with the Palestinians until we've turned up our fight against Zionists. How can we do that? The fact that you've had all these police departments, the Capitol Hill Police Department, Detroit Police Department, Baltimore Police Department, Boston Police Department, New York Police Department, who have gone to Israel and have memorandums of understanding with the Israeli Defense Forces to be trained for the purpose of suppressing popular uprisings in this country. So we need to sit down with the African American Mayoral Association, the National Conference of Black Mayors, and the World Conference of Mayors, and get sworn statements from them on record that no mayors will allow their police forces to go to Israel for training. That's how we can complement the fight. They were 47 Israeli embassies on the African continent. Now it's down to 12. And because of pressure, the African Union stripped Zionist Israel of their observer status. But now it's about us bringing up Israel on criminal charges for their crimes on the African continent. The bombing of Egypt/Kemet in 1967. The fact that Israel's tried to stop Algeria and Tunisia from being recognized as self-determining nations once they got their independence. And the military assistance that they gave to the Portuguese in Angola, in Mozambique, that they gave to the British and the Rhodesians in Zambia, what's called South Africa, and Zimbabwe. So their crimes against the African continent, and the fact that if you're doing Cuba work, if you've done any, and you're against the blockade on Cuba, you already know the only other nation arrogant enough and stupid enough and hateful enough and barbaric enough to want to maintain the blockade on Cuba is Zionist Israel. So we must fight Israel on a multitude of fronts, but Africans must match the resistance of Palestinians based on crimes and atrocities they've committed against us. And if we're not doing that, it's well-intentioned cheerleading at best. And there's no room for pom-poms on the battlefield. But as usual, it's just about understanding our issues in the scheme of this. A month and a half ago, Joe Biden, who was a co-sponsor of the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, he relaxed the sanctions on Zimbabwe, which he imposed back in 2001, for them reclaiming 70% of their most arable and resourceful land and giving it to 350,000 families in a nation where the average family consists of six people, taking it from 4,500 commercial farmers of European ancestry. So the same way you couldn't get us to applaud if you loosened the noose on our neck when you were lynching us, if you loosened the shackles on our ankles and our necks and our wrists when we were being brought here and dropped off all over the Americas. So loosening the sanctions on Zimbabwe doesn't mean anything to us. And the only challenge that we have is Africans and Palestinians can't let anyone or anything come in between them, like the United States Agency for International Development, where you now have these intelligence agencies taking a liberal slant, using humanitarianism to bring about regime change, using philanthropy to bring about regime change, because at the same time he's planning regime change in Cuba, regime change in Venezuela, regime change in Nicaragua, which has the largest African population in Central America. And the fact that in Azania, South Africa, the African National Congress, who has the distinction of being the only liberation movement in Azania, South Africa that did not join the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front. The PAC was front and center. AZAPO was front and center. But the fact that you have the Brenthurst Foundation now, which is the pet project of the Oppenheimers, on the ground in Azania, South Africa, working in partnership with the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern and African Studies, which is the University of Tel Aviv. So we have to get tell the ANC they have to break that relationship and break that tie. So what these encampments serve as is a platform to intensify the activity and to give the activity the ideological direction. So we're maximizing potential, whether it's an encampment, whether it's a teach-in, whether it's a private meeting, but our targets have to be definitively clear. And our artists and our entertainers who like the finer things in life, they love jewelry. They call it bling in the hood. They need to find a go take their jewelry back to their appraiser and find out if it came through Israel before it showed up in New York, before it showed up in Zale, before it showed up in Tiffany's or wherever. If it came through Israel, we're demanding that they take that jewelry back. So until we are fighting Zionism based on their crimes against Africans, past and present, then we're just showing that we're compassionate, which is nothing new to the world. We're showing that we're well-intentioned. But and I'm not talking about these young people, because to say that Zionism is worse in 2024 than it was in 2014, than it was in 2004, than it was in 1994, 1984, 1974 is not accurate. To say that Netanyahu is worse than Golda Meir, is worse than Moshe Dayan, is worse than Ben-Gurion, that would be false. But we can use the momentum of our resistance, how we fought them, and expose the fact that the pro-Zionist entities in our community, like the Harry Belafonte's of the world, like the Bayard Rustin's of the world, were confused, were wrong, and manipulated. And the best way to correct the mistakes of the past is to expose the contradictions of the past, but not to come off as an opportunist expert, not to come off as a cheerleader, but for the purpose of intensifying this resistance in every shape and form we can have that take place.
You know, Brother Mukasa, this notion of intensifying the struggle, but also as the intensification of the repression comes in, we see a lot of the encampments being raided by the police forces. Of course, you are in the South, particularly, I believe in Atlanta or outside Atlanta. We're looking at Cop City. We're looking at the propagation of Cop Cities. But before we kind of unpack this, this intensification, because I think the intensification process that Obi is laying out is very, very important. You were very, obviously involved in and knew of the repression of the state on students in Jackson State, Orangeburg massacre, North Carolina A&T. Could you talk about the importance of understanding? Because again, the purpose of this program is to provide a platform for developing a historical consciousness that leads to an intensification or a cultivation of a process to address these cyclical processes of colonialism. Could you talk about, we're looking at the police repression in UCLA and of course up in New York. This is not new to particularly HBCUs, right? Particularly students, looking at Jackson State, Orangeburg massacre. Could you talk about, that particular instance and what lessons can be learned from that?
Well, we could go back and they shot up Jackson State and killed students on campus. They shot up Texas Southern. They shot up Fisk University. They shot up Tennessee State, murdered all them people in Orangeburg and all around the world. Wherever we speak out, they come to kill us and murder us. So all that's nothing new. But at the same time, our youth and young kids, high school kids, are under attack by the prison industrial complex. And they got all our children in these jails and prisons, got their fathers in jails and prisons. And these are just regular old cotton-picking street people, working people, and we're under attack. And it is worldwide, and it's in every country and every village around the world. Imperialism is flourishing, and that they have pushed us to a position that we have no other choice but to fight to get our land or to fight to solve our problem. And that one of the things that we have to teach our people is organization. Because we got so many people that can break all this down intellectually, but they don't know how to go out and organize like SNCC did or like Marcus Garvey has done. And that I think that we have not trained our people to be organizers. And this is what we need now, people to go to the basketball courts, go to the nightclubs and organize and teach in those players, turn them into schools, go into the streets. And one time we knocked on neighborhood doors, I guess just like the Jehovah's Witness knock on there to spread whatever they be spreading. We have to now have contact, direct contact, eye to eye with the people. And we have to go inside these high schools or outside the high schools or wherever we can get close to these students, because the military is operating on them schools and they organizing our children and putting them into the army, tricking them into the military and sending them to different parts of the world to be killed and to kill and to fight for imperialism. And that if we don't organize for our own children and people, then who gonna do it? We gotta go into these churches and make the churches and teach the churches what it is they're fighting against. Teach them what the real devil is, imperialism and Zionism. Teach them all these little people out here that's going to vote. We made it where they could vote now. We fought and took bombs and killing and lynchings to make it where they could vote. But remember now, it was the Democrats that was throwing the dynamite at us. It was the Democrats that was lynching and killers and killed Cheney, Swartz, and Goodman. It was the Democrats' time when they blew Martin Luther King's mouth off. It was the Democrats when they killed Malcolm X and all that. And they all operated one force. And that Biden and this guy Trump, they getting ready to have a debate. The only thing they're going to be debating is who killed the most Indians. Who going to kill the most Indians? Who killed the most Africans? Who going to drop the most bombs? Who done raped and robbed most of the people in the world? And that's the only debate they're having. And who going to carry colonialism? Who going to steal the most diamonds and gold? Who going to assassinate the most people in the world? Who going to take over there, run all the people off their land in South and Central America? Who going to beat the hell out of them at the borders and starve them and kill them? That's the only thing them punks going to argue.
You're listening to a portion of a discussion, The Role of Historical Consciousness in Global Student Movements, with Mukasa Dada and Obi Aguna Jr. The music in the background is Uhuru by Osibisa. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So we need to now begin to educate and teach our people. We need people that would go to our people and teach them. And we need people that would go out and say, we're going to take this money from these banks or wherever you can get it from, and we're going to help fund organizers and real organizations that's fighting for the people. Everybody got to make some sacrifice for the people, man. You just can't sit back and talk about it. You got to show that you're in the streets. You got to show that you're out there talking to people and converting people and answering the questions and raising the questions with people that they have on their mind. They're looking for somebody to come to them. Most people ain't on the social media. Most people ain't whatever. They need somebody to talk to, and that we need to make sure that we have organizers out here. And now there are some organizations that's claiming and want to be organizers, and this is what we need. We need, and that's one of the things that I think we missed in the 80s and 90s. We gave them the ideological theories, but we didn't give them the technical ways of going into communities and converting and raising conscience of those people. Back in the day, we had to put together freedom schools. We had to put together a whole lot of songs and that songs about freedom and liberation and whatever. And we had to educate people and change their mind. This is the kind of thing that we got to do. We need organizers, and we need organizers like never before. And so many people, Dr. King say, get caught up in the paralysis of the analysis. Anyway, however you put it together, you get paralyzed by just sitting down thinking you right and having all the answers and not being able to go out and do nothing to organize people.
One of the reasons why I thought having this particular conversation, again, to provide a disruption, but also a rich platform for developing a historical consciousness, is not in a context that we're trying to just basically talk about history as something that is in the past, but something that actually we can extend the work of those who have come before. We can extend the work of the Brother Mukasas, who were very integral, because you're talking from, and I want people to understand when you're saying organizing, that you're saying that kind of like matter of factly, but we also have a deep history here, right? You are one of, a principal organizers and helping folk to really understand the importance of the technicalities, the strategy, the deep level of consistency and the scope of organizing, local to national, but also international. And that becomes important because you can see that in the conversation. Brother Obi, you definitely can respond to anything that was said. But one of the things I think is important to kind of tease out what Brother Mukasa is talking about, organizing into organizations or developing institutions. You mentioned Brother Obi, the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front, which is, to be honest with you, it's not even in a conversation, in a dominant discourse, that there was obviously an attempt to a longer genealogy. Again, Brother Mukasa talked about Palestine and the Middle East and the African connections very early, and we can go back there, but have a part two. But talk about, this notion, this idea of that.
Well, what happened was at that particular point for us in the 90s, our point of entry into anti-Zionist work was Libya. And like we tell people now, and understanding that 14 years ago, 500,000 Libyans were slaughtered, maybe more, as a result of NATO and U.S. imperialism, the Obama administration's illegal terrorist invasion of Libya. So we say to people, if you put a dead Libyan and a dead Palestinian next to each other, you couldn't tell which one was which. And they're definitely being slaughtered for the same reason by the same forces. And when you take a look at how brilliant that was for Muammar Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi, to bring Africans from all over the world together to Libya to deal with the Zionist question. And this is why we tell people, when you look at anti-Zionist resistance, there's a pre-Durban and a post-Durban. Because most of the efforts you see now come after 2001, where you had the United Nations Conference Against Racism, Xenophobia, and Other Related Intolerances. And many people went to Azania because Bush said they could not go. And if Palestine was on the agenda, if our captivity was on the agenda and reparations was on the agenda, U.S. imperialism would do everything they can to turn things upside down. So in all actuality, people did not go because of solidarity with the Palestinians. They went to thumb their nose up at Bush. And this is many people who see life itself in the scheme and the lens of the never-ending lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans. But the positive for us is to remind people, once again, you said putting this in historical context, it is Harry Truman, a Democrat, who gave life to Zionist Israel, with, of course, Ralph Bunche out of our community doing the dirty work. When we talk about Cuba, it is Kennedy who imposed the blockade. The Congo is getting a lot of conversation now, and we want to give a shout out to our comrades and the friends of the Congo who have been carrying that work for a very long time. So you go back to the conversation between Eisenhower and Kennedy. Eisenhower said, by all means, bury Lumumba. Kennedy says, don't bury him, but because that would make him a martyr. But under no circumstances should he return to power. So both Kennedy and Eisenhower were for regime change in the Congo. They just had a different methodology in play. Was Reagan worse when he was the rat in Hollywood for J. Edgar Hoover, diming out people who had ties to the Communist Party who were ideologically attracted to the Communist Party? When he was a Democrat governor, destroying the Black Panther Party for self-defense was objective number one? Or was he worse as a Republican president when Maurice Bishop was assassinated in the New Jewel movement. So these are the things that we can use this opportunity. I remember Mukasa and I 10 years ago were walking down the street in Selma with Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. We told them your worst nightmare is if the masses of our people do voter education and begin to look at our historical relationship to both the Democrats and Republicans. And but you shouldn't be bothered by that, because more people will want to join the Rainbow Coalition and the National Action Network as opposed to voting for whoever is running for president at that time, or who's running for Congress, or who's running for the Senate. Targeting key demographics of our community is important. As you know, Brother James, our focus is the children. And we teach through our children, not to our children, because when you teach through the children, you attract the mothers. You attract the fathers, the men of quality in their lives. You attract the grandparents. And before you know it, you're moving the community. And then you're moving the teachers. You're moving the librarians. You're moving the bus drivers. You're moving the mail women. You're moving the mailmen. You're moving the janitors. You're moving the custodians, all because you target children. So there's cultural warfare going on at the same time. So if we are able to come up with, and then, of course, Brother Mukasa mentioned the prisons. Let us not forget that the police, anytime we stand up against naked police terrorism, somebody in our community is going to say, don't do it at the expense of dealing with gun violence or violence prevention. But the violence prevention movement in our community has never aggressively challenged the police in this country and the military in this country for arming the guns, arming our neighborhoods. As a matter of fact, 7 years ago in Selma, Alabama, a Caucasian woman who ran the evidence locker got exposed giving guns to young people in Selma. Selma today only has 20,000 people, but it's the eighth most violent city in North America. So that is to say that the same police department that trained Bull Connor and trained Jim Clark 60 years later is giving 9mm and choppers and derringers to our children in Selma. And the same thing is going on in Chicago. The same thing is going on in D.C. The same thing is going on in Baltimore. And at this moment, Africans in Mexico are talking about suing the United States government, saying that 225,000 U.S. manufactured guns show up in Mexico on an annual basis. And that is responsible for the cycle of violence in Mexico. Here we are, 30 years removed from the United States acknowledging that they put crack in our community to overthrow the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And we never, as a community, have joined hands with Africans in Nicaragua, Africans in Colombia, Africans in Honduras, and the indigenous people in Bolivia, Peru, and Honduras, who can show you what the original intent of the coca plant is. So we're talking about biological warfare. We're talking about traditional police warfare. And we are in a capacity. Another thing is where you are. So those of us who are organizers in Washington, D.C., just by circumstance, anytime we want to, we can put these issues on the world stage, not abandoning the local issues of the people in Southeast, Northeast, Northwest, or Northeast, but tying it into Colombia, tying it into Cuba, tying it into Venezuela, tying it into Africa, tying it into Palestine, tying it into whatever we want to, whenever we want to. The biggest challenge is just the maintenance of the resistance, because we can't expand on the resistance if there's no maintenance. And what we have is temporary, what people call spontaneous, but it's not spontaneous, it's temporary. And the biggest challenge we have is we see resistance with endless potential all the time, but the ability to maintain it will be determined by projects, campaigns, and initiatives that are created from us from the ground up, with no blood money from the enemy, nobody who, as George Soros, is buying our organizations the same way our ancestors were purchased as auctions. That's what's going on now. So bribery cannot be a factor. Manipulation cannot be a factor. Everything we come up with has to be organically from us, from our resistance, from the ground. It cannot have the enemy's footprints, fingerprints, or dollars on it. If you're financed by the enemy, don't you dare come around us telling us you're there to intensify a fight against the enemy. If George Soros feeds you and clothes you, if the MacArthur Foundation feeds you and clothes you politically, don't come around us, you're bluffing at best if you are being financed by the enemy right now. And at a time where our young people are talking about generational wealth, We say what Frantz Fanon said, wealth is not the fruit of labor, but the result of organized protected robbery. So it's not about the accumulation of wealth, but it's the utilization of wealth. What are we going to do with the wealth? And the best thing we can do with our wealth is finance our resistance. So all these organizations that are in the pockets of the enemy, you're contaminating our space.
And
at
also
this historical moment.
And also, you just spoke of Selma. Selma is where we went down and we fought and fought for the right to vote, got beat and all that kind of thing. And today, where people made the greatest prices for registering to vote and trying to register to vote, they're the poorest people probably in Alabama. They're being starved to death. Genocide is being committed on them. Every business has been taken away. And the houses are poorer now than it was 50 years ago. And the people in Selma are being run out. And every year, the enemies, the Democratic Party, pay for a bunch of Uncle Tom doctors and whatever to come down to Selma and make a half program dance and do their buck dancing and march across that old bridge, Ever Pleasant Bridge, and they mad across me at me because I told the people we need to burn the bridge down or blow it up because it ain't nothing but a symbol of oppression where they beat us and beat our people down, made Martin Luther King turn back in a disgraceful way. And that the bridge ain't nothing. And that Uncle Tom be marching across the bridge, waving the American flags and all that. And that they won't invite me to come back down there because I tell the truth. I ain't on their salary. I ain't on their payroll. And that Selma is a symbol of oppression, just like Palestine, just like South Africa, just like the Congo and every other place that we are fighting in the world today. And that we need to expose these Uncle Tom from Sharpton to the rest of them.
Kamala Harris calling for a ceasefire in Selma is the equivalent of J. Edgar Hoover calling for the ending of COINTELPRO after Malcolm X and Martin Luther King got assassinated. It's fraudulent at best. And you can't talk about a poor people's campaign if you're not talking about the fact that there are 3,174 billionaires on this planet. At the same time, there's 709 million people living on $1.90 a day, and 409 million of them live on the African continent. So those of you who are going to Africa carrying the banner of neocolonialism, those of you going to Ghana and have it looking like a HBCU homecoming today, you better go back and look at history. If you say that you're a repatriate, if you're not moving like Julian Mayfield, if you're not moving like Tom Feelings, if you're not moving like Maya Angelou used to move, if you're not moving like Leslie Alexander Lacey and Jim Lacey, if you're not there standing in front of U.S. embassies in every place where you are, then you might as well go into the U.S. embassy and form a memorandum of understanding with them because you're their partner. You're with Rosa Whitaker. You're with the Chamber of Commerce. You're with the Corporate Council on Africa. You're with the U.S. Africa Military Command. You're with the United States Agency for International Development. You're with the National Endowment for Democracy. You're with the National Democratic Institute. You're with the International Republican Institute. You are a partner, which makes you complicit. So whether it's military neocolonialism, whether it's civilian neocolonialism, whether it's, I was in Selma a couple of months ago, and before we went up to the podium, the MC said, be careful what you say. You don't want to mess any of these people's money up. And this factor of bribery, and they felt comfortable saying that to me, knowing we were going to bring up Cuba, knowing we were going to bring up the Congo, knowing we were going to bring up Zimbabwe, knowing we were going to bring up Eritrea, knowing we were going to bring up Selma, knowing we were going to bring up Uniontown, knowing we were going to bring up Colombia, knowing we were going to bring up Venezuela. This is the type of thing that happens. So if you are saying that you are on the front line, and the last thing I'm going to say is what we want the young people to know especially is make a distinction between visibility and impact. You can be seen for 24 hours a day, seen on TikTok, seen on Facebook, seen on Instagram, seen on Zoom, and you are impacting nothing. And the alternative is you are rarely seen. You define when you are seen, how you are seen, and you can impact millions. And that is how we look at the quality of our resistance.
All these Uncle Toms ain't doing nothing but apologizing to Zionism, kissing Zionism feet, apologizing to the Democratic Party, which is the number one killer of people around the world today. And these Uncle Toms ain't nothing but apologetic to these people. And they scared of the people that tell the truth. That's why back in the 60s, we had to pass out tapes on Malcolm X and give out to people and just talk about Malcolm X to everybody, because nobody would say nothing about him on TV. Nobody would say nothing to him about him on the radio. That was against the law. Nobody would say nothing about him in church. Everybody would tell you to call Malcolm X name. Even the Uncle Tom would tell you, shut up, don't use that name. But they tried to poison Malcolm X's name. But through grassroots movement, we put Malcolm X out there. We got T-shirts. We made posters. We just put it everywhere, everywhere. Until today, we made Malcolm, from a grassroots level, one of the most loved men in the world. And that these Uncle Toms that they paying for, putting out front, trying to do everything they can to hush people that would tell the truth. And how they gonna tell me I can't come to Selma? I walked across the bridge right in front of the king to fight. John Lewis helped organize it. And this year they said, you can't come down because you talk too bad about the white folk. You talk too bad about the Democrats. You talk too bad about the Republicans. You want to burn the bridge down. You see the bridge as a bridge of oppression.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Mukasa Dada and Obi Egbuna Jr., which focused on the ongoing fight for Black liberation and the need for solidarity across different oppressed groups. The conversation with African Owls executive producer and co-host James Pope looked at the development and maintenance of a historical consciousness alongside organizing efforts that challenge imperialism, neocolonialism, and police brutality through direct action and community engagement in order to accurately understand the potentialities of the moment. And we had this discussion today as June 16th is the day of the African child, or Soweto Day. The day is set aside to commemorate the youth who rose up against apartheid South Africa on June 16th, 1976 in Soweto, South Africa. And we commemorate that day as we're highlighting the current student movements, particularly those in solidarity with Palestine. The discussion contextualizes student movements historically and globally. The full discussion will be on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Your music in the background is Power by Earth, Wind & Fire, and we play that commemorating Black Music Month in June. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Shah Anana, who's Zain Al-Amin, and that's followed by the Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombitla Kai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineer Michael Nasella. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Koza and Funangonda. And our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Kishikan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdeston. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Equal Rights by Peter Tosh. And we also play that commemorating Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Crying out for justice. don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. Got to get it. Equal rights and justice.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The U.S. is planning to send another Patriot air defense system to Ukraine as President Zelensky calls for more air defense from its Western allies. The Associated Press cited two U.S. officials as saying President Biden approved the Patriot delivery. It would be only the second Patriot system delivered by the U.S., though Germany and other allies have also provided systems. Speaking in Madrid, Zelensky said Ukraine needs another seven Patriot systems to deal with Russian airstrikes on the power grid, civilian areas, and military targets. In related news, the U.S. yesterday lifted a ban on providing U.S. weapons and training to members of the controversial Ukrainian Azov Brigade, some leaders of which had been identified as ideologically neo-Nazi. In a statement, the U.S. State Department said it found no evidence of human rights violations committed by the brigade. Hamas said yesterday that it has responded to a ceasefire proposal from the U.S., suggesting some amendments to the deal in a move that keeps talks alive amid continued devastation in Gaza. A Hamas spokesman said, without providing details, that the amendments, quote, confirm the ceasefire, withdrawal, reconstruction, and prisoner exchange, end quote. Hamas also expressed concern that Israel might not live up to the terms of the deal, particularly the call for a permanent ceasefire and the full withdrawal of Israeli troops. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said today that some of the Hamas amendments are, quote, workable, while others are not. In local news, the Port of Baltimore has been fully reopened following the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in March. Officials say they expect commercial shipping traffic to return to normal levels soon as companies reroute cargo shipments pushed to other ports after the collapse. The work to clean up the collapsed Key Bridge and reopen the channel to the port cost roughly $100 million. Officials say the cost to rebuild the collapsed bridge could reach $2 billion, and could be completed by the year 2028. President Biden has pledged federal funds to cover the full cost of rebuilding the bridge, but Congress has yet to provide approval. The port is particularly important in supply chains for cars and farm equipment. Virginia's chapter of the NAACP filed a federal lawsuit yesterday against the Shenandoah County School Board after the school district restored the names of Confederate generals at two public schools. The school board voted last month to reverse a decision made in 2020 to change the names of schools linked to Confederate leaders Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Turner Ashby. The lawsuit states that students will be, quote, required against their will to endorse the violent defense of slavery pursued by the Confederacy and the symbolism that these images have in the modern white supremacist movement, end quote. The lawsuit argues that the board violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Education Opportunities Act, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and the 14th Amendment, which prohibits racial discrimination in government-supported institutions. The pace of inflation continued to slow in the U.S. last month, sustaining a months-long downward trend in price pressures. Consumer prices, excluding food and fuel, rose only 0.2% from April to May, down from the previous month and the smallest increase since October. Year-to-year inflation was measured last month at 3.4%, also down from the prior month and the smallest increase in 3 years. But even as core inflation continues its downward trend, some items, including food, rent, and healthcare, are still much more expensive than they were 3 years ago. Federal Reserve officials are due to release updated economic projections today, including forecasts of inflation rates and the policy interest rates they use to contain inflation. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 77 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 72 degrees and mostly cloudy. For W.